The briefing is brought to you in association with the Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai is a place for city leaders, developers, architects and designers to come together and innovate for the future of urban spaces. It's an opportunity for the Global South to convene in the Global South. It's a testbed for real-world solutions that will shape the future of people and planet. You can hear from the innovative thinkers and inspirational voices that drove the narrative at this year's edition by listening to Monocle's special episodes of The Briefing, recorded live at Expo City Dubai in March. Find and listen to the shows now at monocle.com or wherever you get your podcasts. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum 2024. Collaborate, innovate, transform.
You are listening to The Briefing, first broadcast on the 17th of January 2022 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to The Briefing, coming to you live from Studio One here at Midori House in London. I am Markus Hippi. Coming up on today's programme, North Korea fires two additional ballistic missiles, its fourth test in less than a month. We'll ask the UK's former ambassador in the country why Pyongyang is flexing its expanding military capabilities. Also ahead, we are in Quebec as the Premier proposes a plan to impose a health tax on those who refuse to get a vaccine.
Various orders of government are right to look at different ways of encouraging and incentivizing people to get vaccinated.
We will also get the latest business headlines with our friends at Bloomberg. And finally, Monocle's culture editor Chiara Rimella brings us a roundup of news from her patch. Chiara, what has caught your eye so far?
Well, we'll be talking about money troubles for the BBC, an auction house readying for public launch, a screaming success for horror movies, and taking NFTs out for dinner.
More from Chiara a bit later. All that and more coming up right here on The Briefing with me, Markus Hippi. We start today in North Korea, where an additional two short-range ballistic missiles were fired this morning from an airport in the capital Pyongyang. This is the fourth test of its kind this month, which has left many neighboring countries concerned as Pyongyang demonstrates its expanding arsenal. I'm now joined in the studio by John Everard, who's the former British ambassador to North Korea. Welcome to the program, John. First of all, how much more can you tell us about this test? The latest one?
Not a great deal more. The information is still trickling in. Two missiles launched, believed to be ballistic missiles, within a short gap from each other. And they appear to have flown something between 200 and 300 kilometres, say the Japanese, splashed down in the sea. We simply don't know anymore because the North Koreans have not released any data. Traditionally, the North Koreans tell the world about the missile tests the day after, so we might know a bit more tomorrow.
Why do you think North Korea is launching all these missiles now? This is indeed the fourth test in less than a month.
Well, the quick answer is, of course, we don't know. But there are various possible explanations. A bit of background first. We seem to sit in the studio and talk about North Korean missile launches.
Regularly,
indeed so. And it may feel a bit samey, but things are actually quite different this time. The key point to grasp is that North Korea is in a horrible mess. It has imposed sanctions on itself because of COVID-19, far more stringent than anything that the United Nations Security Council could have dreamt of. It's brought most of its economy to a standstill. Trade has virtually ceased. The World Food Organization, the World Food Programme rather, has warned of widespread food insecurity, and the regime itself is sufficiently worried about the situation to describe it as grim. That was the word used by Chairman Kim Jong-un himself. Secondly, we have China, traditionally a very strong supporter of North Korea, indeed some might say his only supporter. China, of course, is being distracted right now. We've just seen the economic data come in from China, 8% growth over the year, good, but 4% at the end of the year must be worrying Beijing. A lot of preoccupation, too, with the Winter Olympics that are about to start and with tensions over Taiwan. China has limited bandwidth, and right now it's most unlikely that the woes of North Korea are tops of the mind of the Chinese elite. Thirdly, the regime is simply losing legitimacy. In various meetings last year, Kim Jong-un was complaining that cadres are simply not obeying orders. The whole government machinery is starting to creak quite badly. OK, lots of background. So why have they done it? Firstly, it's possible that this is entirely domestic, that they're not actually trying to signal anything to the international community. What they're trying to do is to remind North Koreans that times may be tough, not a lot of food on the table, bad harvests, but they are still a military power to be reckoned with, and that this is a core source of pride.
Why do you think Kim Jong-un, for example, has been losing his power, or like, you know, he's saying that he's not being followed that carefully anymore? Why is he losing his authority?
Probably because he's failing to deliver. He made this big spiel at the beginning of his regime about how he was going to bring about economic prosperity to North Korea. That manifestly has not happened. He engaged with the Americans at top level, much hope that that would bring about a big change in North Korea. Again, that whole thing fell apart. And of course, he's young. You know, he's climbing quite a hill there. In North Korea, you have to have a few grey hairs to be taken seriously, and Kim Jong-un is a kid. It has been noticeable for a long time that whereas in big political meetings, with Kim Jong-il, his father, and certainly with Kim Il-sung, his grandfather, all the cadres present would carefully write down every word the leader said. The live television in North Korea shows the cadres simply looking away and ignoring Kim Jong-un. Almost from the off, he's had trouble with credibility.
Is it good news, though, that North Korea hasn't fired intercontinental ballistic missiles or conducted nuclear tests since 2017?
Yes, of course it is, although the resumption since effectively September last year is bad news. I think they're holding back from launching intercontinental ballistic missiles because they know that that is a Chinese red line, and right now they simply cannot afford to annoy China. One small action in the background that hasn't been widely reported. This morning, for the first time in, I think, 18 months, a Chinese goods train rolled across the border into North Korea. Trade between the two countries, which is North Korea's lifeline, is just starting to restart, if that's a phrase. And the North Koreans will not want to do anything to upset them.
Do you think China is going to put North Korea back in order eventually once the Olympic Games, for example, have ended?
No, I think China simply has other fish to fry. I mean, China follows China's interests, not North Korea's. It will continue to make sure that North Korea doesn't implode, insofar as China can judge that, which is itself something of a question. And it will want a China-friendly regime in North Korea. But that's about as far as it cares about North Korea.
How far would Beijing go? You mentioned that North Korea doesn't want to cross that red line, but what if it did?
Oh, we know what the Chinese would do because they've done it in the past. They suddenly develop technical faults in the oil pipeline. Suddenly, you know, trade stops. Customs inspections on the border are trebled and nothing actually gets into North Korea. China has sufficient levers on North Korea to bring the North Koreans to heel in about 48 hours, anytime it wants.
What do you think North Korea wants from the world at the moment?
Attention. North Korea is terrified of being ignored and so slowly imploding under its own domestic problems. It wants lots of money as well. Somewhere at the bottom of all this, there is a bid for cash from somewhere. It may be China, it may be the United States, it may be South Korea. But North Korea really needs money quickly to get its economy in order.
And if Pyongyang doesn't get what it wants, do you think we may return to the era of fire and fury in terms of relations between North Korea and the West?
Yes, I suspect that if it doesn't get what it wants, assuming that this is indeed a bid for attention, and I said, you know, there's the different interpretations of what's going on, it may well keep upping the ante, launch more and more provocations. It's unlikely to continue to do so into February because, of course, in February we have the Winter Olympics, and I think if North Korea launched a major provocation during the Olympics, China would throw a wobbly, and that would put North Korea in a very bad position. That's one possibility. The other is, of course, that the regime is right, the situation is really, really grim, and that North Korea does, in fact, implode.
Just finally, John, South Korean President Moon Jae-in has vowed to use his last months in office to press for some kind of a diplomatic breakthrough with North Korea. Do you see any reason for optimism at the moment?
Yawn. Moon Jae-in has been saying this for how long now? And we've had how many meetings and how many promises? And now he's got about a month left. He thinks he's going to crack it. Sorry, I just don't buy it.
John Everard there. Thank you very much for joining us here on Monocle 24. And now here is Paige Reynolds with the day's other news headlines.
Thanks, Marcus. Beijing will require travellers to get a COVID-19 test within 72 hours of arrival. The announcement comes a day after the city reported its first Omicron case and as it prepares to stage the Winter Olympics next month. The games are being held inside a closed loop, separating athletes and personnel from the general public. New Zealand has sent a plane to Tonga to assess the damage after a huge volcanic eruption triggered a tsunami. Around 80,000 people live in the Pacific Islands, and the eruption has covered the area in ash, cut powder, and severed communications. The chairman of global banking giant Credit Suisse, Antonio Horta Azorio, has resigned with immediate effect after breaking COVID-19 regulations. His exit follows an internal investigation and comes 9 months after he was hired to help the bank deal with a series of scandals. Credit Suisse says it will stick to the strategic overhaul developed by Horta Azorio. And the White House has announced that it will spend more than $27 billion to repair and rebuild thousands of bridges across the country. This funding represents the largest ever federal investment in the nation's more than 47,000 bridges. You can read more about this story at monocle.com/minute. Those are the day's headlines. Back to you, Marcus.
Thank you very much, Paige. Let's now get a quick update on the day's main business news with Bloomberg's Euan Potts. Thanks for joining us, as always, Euan. So first of all, analysts have been making their views clear in the battle for some big consumer health brands. Could you tell us more?
Marcus, yeah, it's not unusual for companies making takeovers to see their share price drop. Investors are wary of firms making these grand acquisitions, which often end up destroying shareholder value. It's quite common to see the acquiring company see its shares fall whilst the other company, of course, sees its shares rise. Well, analysts are today being pretty clear that they're not very keen on Unilever's £50 billion offer for GlaxoSmithKline's consumer health business. Now, GSK said over the weekend it turned down three offers from Unilever for its massive consumer health business. This is a company which owns brands like Panadol, and Advil painkillers and Sensodyne toothpaste, a whole range of consumer goods brands, which is owned by GlaxoSmithKline, the massive UK drug maker. Well, now Unilever wants to get its hands on these, but analysts are not very keen. One of them writing simply, please don't. Unilever has no overlap with two-thirds of Glaxo's consumer health business and little experience in some of the regulatory issues for medical and clinical products. That was the view of one analyst. Investors have been dumping Unilever shares today. They're down some 7% earlier on this morning. Glaxo said in a statement over the weekend that they received these three unsolicited offers, but Glaxo saying so far the £50 billion which Unilever is offering is simply not enough.
Now, you and the World Economic Forum is taking place this week, sadly online instead of the Swiss Alps. And Chinese President Xi Jinping has already been speaking there. What have we heard from him?
Yeah, it's the third time that China's president has addressed delegates at the World Economic Forum. As you say, this time very much online. Xi Jinping saying that we need to resolve various risks and promote the steady recovery of the world economy. He's warning about global inflation and also the knock-on effects of higher interest rates. Xi says that if major economies slam on the brakes or take a U-turn in their monetary policies, there will be serious negative spillovers. He says particularly for developing countries. He says that the chance that they would bear the brunt of it. Now, interesting, if you look back, the first time that Xi addressed the World Economic Forum back in 2017 was just days before President Trump's inauguration in the US. At the time, Xi warned against the trade war and condemned protectionism, which, as it turned out, was rather prescient because, of course, Beijing and Washington were there, then embroiled in exactly that over the coming years. So let's hope he doesn't foresee more global problems coming down the line for the economy. It's interesting data out of China today, actually. GDP grew by 4% year on year in the latest quarter. That's the weakest pace since early 2020. Quite a slowdown for the Chinese economy. China actually cutting interest rates. Interestingly, most global economies are considering increasing rates. There's always talk of perhaps as many as four hikes from the US. The UK has already put up interest rates. So most central banks are looking to tighten policy. China, at the moment, is looking to loosen it.
We'll be following, obviously, the World Economic Forum here on Monocle 24 this week. One more topic for you, Ewan. Tell us about the new analysis we're getting on the problem of soaring energy bills.
Yeah, energy bills, energy prices have been soaring right across Europe. In fact, the energy price rises are something which is faced right around the world. But some interesting analysis here in the UK from campaign group, the Resolution Foundation. They say that more than 6 million households in England will struggle to pay their energy bills from April. Now, here in the UK, we have a price cap on energy bills, and that is reviewed every 6 months. We're going to find the result of the latest review in 3 weeks' time. That could see bills rise by 50 or 60% from April. And according to the Resolution Foundation, that means that as many as a quarter of households could struggle to pay their bills. Their definition of struggling is when households spend at least 10% of their budgets on electricity or gas. At the moment, only around 1 in 10 households are in that position, but the Resolution Foundation says that could be as many as a quarter of households. So that is a big increase in the number of households who will find it difficult to pay their energy bills. In France, we saw last week that EDF, the big energy supplier in France, has been ordered not to increase bills as much as planned. That saw a big sell-off in EDF shares at the back end of last week. So countries all around Europe really struggling to get a grip on these rising bills and just how they're going to be kept down.
Bloomberg's Ewan Potts there. Thank you very much for this update. You are listening to The Briefing on Monocle 24. You are back with a briefing on Monocle 24. I am Markus Hippi. In Canada last week, the Premier of Quebec, François Legault, announced a proposal to impose a tax on residents who refuse a vaccine for COVID-19. The proposal is one of the most eye-catching among many being mulled by governments around the world, as the rhetoric against the vaccine's opponents appears to be hardening. Monocle's Toronto Bureau Chief Thomas Lewis assesses the reaction to the proposed policy one week on since it was made.
Canada's vaccination rate against COVID-19 is among one of the highest in the world. That means that there's been little public sympathy, broadly speaking, for the minority of people in Canada who oppose being compelled to get vaccinated. That pro-vaccine sentiment is already reflected in parts of federal law here. Federal employees must show proof of vaccination, for example, before they take up a government job. And it's illegal for an unvaccinated person to board a plane or a train in Canada, a policy that was announced by Prime Minister Justin Trudeau last October, following his party's victory in last summer's general election.
If you've done the right thing and gotten vaccinated, you deserve the freedom to be safe from COVID-19, to have your kids safe from COVID, to get back to the things you love. And if you haven't gotten your shots yet but want to travel this winter, let's be clear. There will only be a few extremely narrow exceptions, like a valid medical condition. For the vast, vast majority of people, the rules are very simple. To travel, you've got to be vaccinated.
But the pressure on many of Canada's health networks is pronounced at the moment, as the Omicron variant of the virus, the spread of which, according to some measures, appears to be slowing slightly in parts of Europe, for example, is still in many places here on the rise, as it is south of the border in the United States. And that's the context in which the Premier of Quebec, François Legault, made the announcement last week that proposed taxing those who refuse a COVID-19 vaccine.
The vaccine is the key to fight the virus. This is why we're looking for an health contribution for adults who refuse to be vaccinated for non-medical reasons. Those who refuse to receive their first dose in the coming weeks will have to pay a new health contribution. I know the situation is tough, but we can get through this together.
The proposal, and it is still just a proposal at the moment, has divided opinion.
There are many downsides. First, it will polarize people. It will increase conflict in the society. between people that are vaccinated and those that are not vaccinated. And this may be an issue. And also penalize some marginalized people. We know, for example, in Europe that having a precarious financial situation is one of the main predictors of vaccine hesitancy. So it will be, if this is implemented, it will be a regressive tax in the sense that on average, there will be poorer people may pay a bigger burden than richer people with this tax.
And while other premiers have said that they won't consider a similar policy in their own corners of the country, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has been cautious to judge the suggestion either way.
While Justin Trudeau wants more information about Quebec's plan to tax the unvaxxed, he's also not denouncing it.
Various orders of government are right to look at different ways of encouraging and incentivizing people to get vaccinated.
The most revealing response so far, however, might well be from the public itself. The day after the policy was proposed, more than 7,000 people in Quebec were reported to have signed up for their first dose of the vaccine in a single day. Whether or not this eye-catching, perhaps controversial policy ever makes it into law, there appears to be a constitutional and legal mountain to climb if that's to happen. The mere suggestion of a financial penalty for those hesitant to get vaccinated appears to have spurred some in Quebec to roll up their sleeves. For Monocle in Toronto, I'm Thomas Lewis.
Thanks to Thomas for that update. You are with The Briefing on Monocle 24. And finally on today's programme, it's time for a roundup of the week's cultural stories with Monocle's own culture editor Chiara Rimmella. She joins me here at Midori House Studio One. Good afternoon to you.
Well, good afternoon, Marcus.
Shall we start with news from the UK about the BBC, the public broadcaster?
Yeah, indeed. I mean, this is happening just down the road, but I think it's a very important story from the point of view of the future of public broadcasting around the world. I mean, the news is from yesterday, and it's about the fact that the licence fee is being rethought, that the funding is being frozen for the next 2 years, and then there is this suggestion that the licence fee will be abolished in 2027. And that opens up a whole host of questions about how the BBC will fund itself once the licence fee is indeed gone, and whether it will have to edge more towards a subscription service type programming, or whether it will have to rely more on private funding, or whether it will become completely kind of state-run. All of these potential options have issues. And I think it's a very interesting question to ask ourselves in terms of the future of public broadcasting, because the BBC is so well-regarded internationally. And what does that mean if the quality of the programming of the BBC does indeed decrease, because there will be less money going round and they will have to cut back on high-quality drama? What does that mean for people who do watch it, who might not necessarily feel like they want to watch it anymore? And if this idea of, you know, the BBC has been struggling also in terms of competing with the likes of Netflix and these kind of streaming services, will this spell even another win for the Netflixes of the world?
Absolutely. I think it's interesting how public broadcasters, I guess, across the world are having a bit of tricky times at the moment. Here in the UK, for example, we've seen the BBC being a battleground for culture wars, for example. Some politicians are questioning its impartiality, as in many other countries as well. If you look at, for example, Italy, what is the discussion like over there?
Well, I think public broadcasting in Italy has always been fraught with political issues, because the media in Italy, particularly broadcast media, has always been so fraught in political alliances. Berlusconi owns three major channels. And so Rai has been a real political battleground, because by some it was considered too oppositional to Berlusconi's channels. On the other hand, the appointment of the main kind of heads of the different channels of Rai was a very, very political maneuver, and many have felt that it's been too politically pleasing to Berlusconi's sides in the past. So I think that the importance of public broadcasting in a country like Italy, where you have, you know, a very important political figure at the head of three major broadcasting channels, is perhaps not exactly the same as the UK, but it goes to prove that public broadcasting really does have a place. And if we keep eroding it for the, you know, to going more towards streaming services because they are the ones taking the funding at the moment, then the quality of the non-news programming actually does affect the quality of the news programming as well. I mean, Marcus, you've worked in public broadcasting back in Finland. What is the situation there?
Well, over there, when I was working for the Finnish Broadcasting Company, there was a great concern over the funding in the future, because that's the time when politicians were suggesting that maybe TV license fee is not the right way to fund the YLE. And indeed, a few years ago, Finland decided to switch to television tax or public broadcaster tax. So you kind of end up paying for the public broadcaster in any case, regardless whether you have a television or not. I think it simplifies things. You don't need television license inspectors. No one is ringing your doorbell if you don't have a television or if you haven't paid for the license. It does simplify things a little bit, but obviously there's always the great concern of over what politicians decide and do they actually want to keep on funding the public broadcaster.
Absolutely. And I think that many are taking this measure for the BBC, for example, to be a real kind of knee-jerk reaction by the Tory party. The fact that it's been announced now, some are saying it's just to kind of get back a little bit of consensus whilst Boris Johnson is definitely going through a rough patch. So this is a fairly kind of perhaps, popular move if you don't feel like you will have to pay that money for the public broadcaster, particularly if you feel like it's already left leaning. So there's a lot of kind of political maneuvering around this measure for sure.
Interesting story. That we'll definitely be following that. But let's continue now with some other headlines from For This Week. Sotheby's is heading for an IPO.
Yes, so this is, the rumour or the suggestion that Sotheby's has enlisted Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley to see if they can have an IPO, and they're apparently seeking a valuation of $5 billion. I think this is really interesting because it comes just off the news that Sotheby's has had its recorded its highest ever numbers in 2021. Highest grossing year ever with 7.3 billions record. And I think it's interesting because Sotheby's has really been at the front of repositioning auction houses in a completely different way. You know, when the pandemic started, we were all wondering whether the art market would collapse. It clearly hasn't. And it hasn't particularly because auction houses have been able to completely kind of galvanize.
What have they done right?
They've galvanized a generation of younger collectors, partly because of their moves into digital. Obviously, we can talk to no end about NFTs, but really those moves into digital have lured in a younger generation of collectors that feel like they have an entry point to this market now. Perhaps they weren't able to spend in 2020 on other things they would have normally spent on. But it's created a whole new market. And it's not just NFTs. I mean, NFTs maybe kind of lure some of these collectors in, but then they end up spending on other physical things, maybe paying with crypto to buy physical things. It's really interesting how, you know, Sotheby's has really been at the forefront of this. They were the first ones to kind of do an NFT auction, but really they have completely repositioned themselves. And auction houses as a whole, I think, have really benefited from the last couple of years. And we can see it, you know, written down in quite hard numbers.
Very good news. Let's continue with some other good news from the film industry.
Well, I think this is interesting because I personally wouldn't have expected Scream to be a surprise kind of box office hit, but perhaps you think differently,
Marcus. I was just going to say that I literally was thinking about this the other day. I want to go and see that because it's actually something. Maybe I'm actually explaining now why this film may have done so well. But, you know, we've been having a bit of tricky times recently, so you need something that's just a bit silly and kind of predictable and kind of, you know, you want those jokes and you want those references to the older Scream films and kind of, in a way, that is just, you know, something that takes you away from the worries of the pandemic.
Absolutely. I mean, I've commissioned a very good Jamie Waters to do a story about Shudder, for example, which is a horror streaming platform, and they have really grown through the pandemic. People, I guess, like the experience of horror in a way that is kind of confined. You watch a film, you scare yourself in that specific time frame. You are so used, I guess, to fear that it is aimed at nothing that you want to control it through the experience of fear in that specific kind of film size little parcel. But I think it's really interesting because not only does it mean that horror is popular, but also this is a film that I guess is appealing at a younger audience. We're seeing that the vast majority of people who are going are between 18 and 35, meaning that younger people still are interested in going to the cinema, which is good news because it means that it's not just streaming platforms forever. And that perhaps big cinema producers may want to stop holding their big titles until later on in the year because people are going to the cinema, and this is proof.
One more story. You mentioned we talked about crypto already, and we continue with a restaurant where you can enter only by paying in NFTs.
Not quite, but I do want to appeal to your persona as like the presenter of the menu, as this kind of cross kind of culture plus gastronomic tie-up. So the idea is that to enter Fly Fish Club, which will apparently open by 2023, is that you have to have a proof of membership, which is an NFT. Mm-hmm. But then when you're inside, you actually pay with money and you get given real food. So that's
that's good.
That's a reassurance that you won't just be eating crypto. But it's amazing because to have a standard membership, so they've been selling for 2.5 Ethereums, which is about $7,900, to have a membership to enter this restaurant. And then these memberships, in the form of an NFT, have been resold on OpenSea platform. So basically, you're paying $7,900 rather, to enter this restaurant and eventually eat fish.
What's the appeal?
Well, I guess people like things that are really, really exclusive and really, really like seafood. What can I say?
Are you booking your flights to New York already for 2023?
Listen, I was going to go in 2022, but maybe I'll hold off for the grand event.
Fair enough. Monocle's culture editor Chiara Rimmela there. Thank you very much for joining us today. And that's all for this edition of The Briefing. It was produced by Carla Torribello and our studio manager was Christy Evans. The Briefing is back tomorrow at the same time at midday here in London, 7 a.m. if you're listening in Washington, D.C. I am Markus Hippi. Goodbye and thanks for listening.